This is podcast number 5 for the House Einstein podcast. And in this podcast, we're going to be talking about opportunity costs in real estate. My name is Osman Parvez, and joining me is Hamish Crabb.
Hello.
And here we go. So last time we put the podcast notes on the blog and the recording on the blog, we're going to do the same thing for this podcast, but we're also going to we are going to create those in real time as we move through it with our outline. When I switch to the outline, Hamish, is that visible on the screen or no? That's not something that people can see?
No.
Okay. All right. So that's fine. We'll just put the outline into the show notes at the end. So basic concepts. Let's start there. What is the definition of opportunity cost? And if you pull it up, which I'm doing right now, and pull the Wikipedia definition, it says, in microeconomic theory, the opportunity cost of a choice is the value of the best alternative foregone where given limited resources, a choice to be made between several mutually exclusive alternatives. Assuming the best choice is made, it is the cost incurred by not enjoying the benefit that would have been had by taking the second best available choice. And in real estate, where this comes up most frequently is in home selection. So if you were to buy one particular house, make that decision to put it under contract and move toward buying it, you are incurring a potential opportunity cost for other homes that are on the market or might appear on the market in the future. In other words, you can't buy more than one house. Well, you can. Some people do. But most people buy one house at a time for their primary use. And one of the biggest problems, one of the biggest challenges they feel in making that decision to write an offer is they don't know what else is potentially coming in the next few months during their window of opportunity to buy a home. And understanding that cost and mitigating it, mitigating the risk of a bad decision is part of what we do on the buy side. But there are other examples in life, and there are other examples in real estate other than the most obvious avoidance of choosing the wrong house or choosing a house where a better one might have appeared at a risk that you just can't accept. So does that make sense to you, Hamish? Do you understand the core
concept?
Yeah,
that tracks.
Yeah. So the analogy that I put it in the outline is dating and relationships. For most people, when they make a commitment to a significant other, it's often monogamous. Not everyone makes a monogamous decision, but let's say you're in a normative monogamous relationship that is long-term. Well, that means you're not dating other people at the same time, right? And the fact that you chose to date person A means you're not dating person B, and there's a cost associated with that. Now, with dating or with real estate, it's not quite as measurable because we're talking about happiness, we're talking about relationships, we're talking about a place where you're putting your family and yourself, your living. It's not like any other asset class. If you're buying 2 shares of stock, and we could do this quite easily, and this is one of the examples I put into the notes, into the outline. Let's say you had $100,000 inheritance, and today you could spend that $100,000 on a vehicle, or you could spend that $100,000 on shares of Amazon. Well, if you had that decision 20 years ago and you spent the $100,000 on a fancy S-Class Mercedes, and Hamish and I are both car guys, so we're comfortable talking about cars. We know the numbers. We know the models. So this is Mercedes's luxury sedan, which would have been, even 20 years ago, over $100,000. And you bought Amazon stock, what would the difference be, right? So we know, and I'm just going to go look at, you know, my personal tracking of Amazon stock on TradingView, but you could use Yahoo Finance. AMZN is the ticker, and I'm pulling it up. I'm not sharing screen, Hamish, so maybe we should.
Yeah.
Let's see. Is there a button for me to share screen? Oh, yeah, there it is. Okay. Share screen. Might be more interesting. Choose the tab. Okay, let's share this tab. Share tab audio, no. Share. Okay. All right. So we're looking at Amazon stock. Actually, we're looking at Alex Honnold. I guess he's a spokesperson for Amazon stock. I don't want to join. What happened here? How do I stop this?
It seems as though you don't have a choice.
I used to just let me do it without joining. I do have an account, but I don't really want to log in to TradingView. So we'll just use it. All the pop-ups.
Jeez.
All right. Just show me the stock price. It's sort of funny. Back in my analyst days, we used Yahoo Finance in the brokerage, in the investment firm, every day.
Wow.
To quickly get the data we need. So old habits die hard. Full screen. Oh, man. No, try
later. Speaks to its reliability, though.
It does. It has been very reliable. I don't know if Yahoo has been able to monetize this tool. But so 20 years ago, we're talking about 2003, right? So let's back up to 2003. And, you know, we're kind of going into this explanation just because not everyone understands the concept of opportunity cost, and it's helpful to illustrate it.
Me included here, yeah.
Bear with me if this is something you fully understand. We'll get through it pretty quickly. But Amazon stock back in 2003, it's not even letting me. Hold on, I got to look at the little box. You see the little box on the left? That's where the stock price is. 2003. I'm not going to download the whole table. It doesn't have to be perfectly exact. So we're talking about April 6th, 2003. The stock was $1.29 a share, and it really wasn't. They've adjusted it, you know, when there's splits and that sort of thing. So that's the nice thing about Yahoo Finance. They will backwards and all the online stock investment tools. They will revise the whole data series so it's accurate by today. So yes. It would have been $1.30 or $1.29, and even though the stock has been pummeled recently, it traded at $97. So, or 97.61. So you do the quick math, right? 97.61 divided by a dollar. What do we say? A dollar 29
or 30?
Dollar 30. Okay. So, and so that's a 74 times multiple on your money. So if you had taken that $100,000, you know, in 2002, and you invested it exclusively at Amazon, it would be worth 74 times 100. Hamish, what's the math?
740.
That's right. $7.4 million is what you would have in cash today.
Yeah.
If you took that $100,000 inheritance and invested it in Amazon 20 years ago. Of course, nobody has a crystal ball. Nobody knew Amazon would be such a winner. It went from selling books to selling everything. And a bunch of other things too. Amazon Web Services is a huge component of its business, and certainly wasn't in the original business plan that Jeff Bezos put together. So $7.4 million is what your $100,000 would be worth today. And now let's quickly look at AutoTrader. Let's see what a 20-year-old Mercedes goes for.
Yeah, and we're looking in 2003, you know. So I really don't recommend looking up the 7 series of that generation.
Oh, we really should look at the 7. That's really your same value, isn't it?
Oh, it's no, that one's such a worse car.
Oh, all right. Okay. All right, let's look up the not minis. They didn't exist. Well, they did, but they weren't okay. Let's find. It doesn't like Mercedes for some reason. It doesn't want me to get to this. There it goes. Mercedes-Benz S-Class. What year? 2003, right? Let's say any distance. We like cars here. Any distance 2002 to 2003. See if there's any of them even on AutoTrader. They're probably worth so little that it's not worth paying for the ad. All right, and then we're looking anywhere in the country, right?
All right. Your screen share is still on the Yahoo Finance.
Oh, okay. Oh, sorry. How do I switch that? Let's go to screen share. Stop sharing. Screen again. It's probably a better way. We're still learning this new software for managing podcasts. So this is AutoTrader. And this is they show you the ad at the top, but this is the search for that vintage of Mercedes, and you're looking at $6,000, $6,400, maybe $9,000 on this one. Oh, you've got one that crossed 11. So your $100,000 is worth 5.5 to 11% of its original value versus 74 times so you can obviously see the point, right? So the opportunity cost is measurable in having made the decision to go buy a vehicle when you could have bought Amazon stock. And you can actually calculate that difference, 7.4 million versus 5,000, 6,000 bucks. I mean, it's so laughable as a difference in opportunity cost. But we don't know the future, right? We don't know what the future in Boulder looks like. We don't know what the future in relationships with our partners look like. We don't know what our job situations could change. So we can't necessarily easily forecast 20 years into the future what real estate in Colorado would look like or anywhere in the world. But you do have an opportunity to choose wisely and compare it to other choice. You've chose house A, you can't buy house B. And understanding that risk, the opportunity cost risk, is crucial in making intelligent real estate decisions. And it's not as easily measurable in when you're considering your opportunity cost, because unlike stock prices and car prices, happiness is not a metric that's easily quantified. Fulfillment and satisfaction, but we do know there are some proxies for it, right? We know that your commute time, right, is one of the leading indicators, one of the most important factors with happiness with real estate selection or with job selection too, like either way. Because if you're stuck in the car driving into Manhattan every day from the boroughs or Westchester County or Connecticut, and you're taking the train, and this is for the Northeast people that are listening, that's a pretty miserable experience every day. That's over an hour each way every day into the office. And yes, we now live work from home, so there are other things that come into play. And out here in Colorado, we were one of the highest work from home states to begin with, and it's just accelerated. Go into any neighborhood in Boulder, and you will see in the middle of the day people exercising, people walking that are clearly of working age, and they have work. Likely they are working and not just retired, and they are simply enjoying their day and blending their work life into their play life like we do at House Einstein. We don't have a normal work schedule. So that's something to think about. And how do you mitigate this, right? Will there be a better house in the future? Will prices go up or down? What potential life changes might happen to you or your family in terms of mobility? How close do you need to be to a healthcare center? What about schooling? Like right now, if you were looking to buy a home and you don't have children, you may say, well, kids don't matter to us. Or maybe you could even say that our kids are out of the house, right? We don't care about schools. But schools are actually a very good proxy. School performance is a very good proxy for real estate performance. They tend to track each other. So you still shouldn't ignore it. And then you can also think about long-term appreciation trends and the factors that influence those, including things like the giant donut of open space that surrounds Boulder and which would be incredibly difficult to develop. And I no longer say impossible, given what's going on in our political climate right now in Colorado with SB, what's the number? SB 231?
Oh, I couldn't tell you.
The new legislation that Governor Polis has proposed, which will radically change the regulatory environment for development throughout Colorado. And they just announced it's being pared back, but it likely, some form of it will pass. And that's also going to change the future of what your neighborhood might look like. So just because you have a beautiful single family house next to you and a view over it from your house doesn't mean there won't be an apartment building there in 5 years, because this type of zoning change actually allows and encourages full-on apartment buildings, not just quadplexes and duplexes, but it overrides things like height limits and compatible development and other rules like we have here, local control over what gets built. So all of those are things that I feel like are important to have discussions around in the context of opportunity cost on the buy side. And then the question becomes, well, how do you mitigate these things? So Hamish, are you still following?
I'm tracking. Yep, I'm still here.
Are you tracking? No. Okay.
Yeah.
I would like, you know, anytime something's not clear, for you to just say it's not clear, because that gives us an opportunity to jump into it. Maybe I'm not being clear. It's not that you don't understand. Let me make that abundantly clear to you and to anybody who, you know, to all 12 people who are listening to this.
We should probably touch on the factors, you know, that kind of influence our buy side opportunity cost decision, and perhaps some factors that people don't necessarily consider. Like, you touch on schools. Even if I were to go buy a house, I'm not planning on having a kid for a very long time. So, but it should still be a back of the mind thing, right?
I don't know if it should be back of the mind or on the front of your mind. And one of the things we did early on in this business was actually develop a scorecard for our buyers. And this was an era where we had lots of inventory. I mean, there was so much inventory in 2005 and 6 and 7 that we felt like it was like this, we just thought that was normal. And today we have probably 20% that volume of inventory, that available options of homes to buy. So a scorecard just seems like an incredible luxury. But it is important to talk about what are the most important things to you in purchasing a home. And Hamish is currently shopping for his first home. So this is very real, right? What are the most important criteria? And we usually start with functional requirements, bedrooms and baths, garage spaces, of course, price. You can't get away from price. But then also, do you want a home that has a primary bedroom on the main, or are you okay if the primary is on an upper or lower level, a split level? Doesn't work for a lot of people because they don't like having their children on the lower level. So it might work for you today, Hamish, but in whatever year, if you are planning to have children, little kids in a basement or in a, it's not even fully in a basement.
Across the house, yeah.
Across the house or on a lower level in the middle of the night, they're crying. You're now navigating stairs to get down there. It's not an ideal scenario. Most people feel psychologically better if their family is on the same floor as them. And that's until they turn into teenagers, in which case they really want them in the basement and as far away from them as they can get. Split levels work for people that don't have kids or people that have older kids. But they don't work well for people that are...
call it emerging families.
Yeah. They may not be thinking in these terms. And that's part of our job is to have that discussion, because it really is unfortunate if a client has to sell their house within a short period of time of acquisition. And there are always personal factors, but if it's something that we didn't properly disclose or help them understand and we could have, I feel really bad about that decision. Even though there's a financial opportunity, right, to help them sell the house they decided they no longer want, and ultimately it is their decision and their risk, but I still feel like we screwed up somehow by not telling them. And my first year in the business, Hamish, my very first year, we helped a buyer acquire a condo for himself, and we did not realize the condo did not allow dogs. And he got there with his dog, and he was informed he cannot have a dog, and it was awful. And we sold the condo at zero cost. I listed it and sold it at zero cost. He had to pay the 2.8, but we were able to get – that's the commission. He had to pay the buy-side commission, but it was enough of a margin that he didn't lose money, but it still could have been a disaster. And after that, I learned that even though these things are technically due diligence that falls to the buyer, these are such obvious things to a realtor that's been working in this industry for, you know, any measurable length of time and does this full time. You see these things coming, and checking the rules, the association rules, and making sure that you can live within them is important. And we make sure we now have a process for our buyers, when there is an association, to ask, have you reviewed the rules? Are you cool with them? Is there any concerns you have? As well as digging into the financials of the HOA. Also, how the rules are managed. Are you being harassed if your garbage cans are not inside the the inside the garage within 15 minutes of the trash truck going by? Yeah. Are you getting a ticket from the HOA? That sort of stuff we always look into for helping to understand HOAs. But the HOAs are an entirely different podcast, Amish. We will go there, too. Maybe not this one. Yeah.
No. It's, you know, once you've been in kind of the industry long enough, you start to pick up on these little nuanced things, right? And that's part of the service is having that experience behind you and asking the questions that a buyer wouldn't necessarily think of on firsthand.
And that's fine. And maybe future-proofing for children or for mobility is not high priority for you at this point in time. And your thought process is in 5 or 7 years, I'll buy a different house and I'll turn this into a rental. That's fine. So maybe it's low down on the scorecard as a priority and is not something you should worry about. But at least we've mentioned it. And that those types of conversations help mitigate property selection, right? Helps you mitigate the opportunity cost of choosing a home. But so does, there are other things we can do to help mitigate that. So this is an uncommon approach that I do with the vast majority of my buyers, often early in the process. I will schedule a meeting with them and we will share screen. I do this in real time and I send them all of the sales in the last year or the last 6 months, depending on how many we get in the search. But we set up their listing alerts. And at the same time, I send them a list of what would have matched in the last 6 to 12 months. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. And the idea of that is, okay, if this is what the last 6 months or 12 months of the market looked like, how many homes in this set would you have found acceptable? And if the answer is, okay, well, we've gone through the 100 houses that sold in the last 12 months, and there were only 5 that we would have bought based on whatever our personal scorecard is. Well, that tells you something about when a house appears on the market that matches, it's 5, 1 of 5 in the last 100. 5% you are a buyer that will only choose 5% of the available homes in your price range, in your location, that meet your functional requirements. Like, well, that's the MLS search. It's like a general screen. If we know it's only 5% and suddenly the right house appears next weekend, this risk of opportunity cost is incredibly low, that you're going to see another one like it that is better. But if we see of those 100 houses, 90% of them you would have gladly bought, well, then you know that if a house appears and it's being overbid and you don't, you know, you're being asked to remove your contingencies or reduce them around inspection, you don't have to go so aggressive. You're like, there's going to be another house. I'm okay not getting this one because I know 90% of the homes that fit my functional requirements and meet my price range and are in the location I want will work for me as a buyer.
Right.
So that's one of the most important things we do to mitigate opportunity cost. The risk of making a bad real estate decision, I guess, is the other way to think about it. Or the risk of feeling regret. Because remember, you're not really incurring these costs for real, right? Like, you're not actually you're only getting the benefit and loss of the home you end up buying. But measuring quantitatively and qualitatively the opportunity cost of other real estate you could have bought is an important part of the process of making smarter decisions.
What do you think about, you know, after you go under contract on a house, just the general idea, just to don't look at any new listings, you know, and focus on what you got, that type of looking back regret?
It's hard for people because they don't want it. So the contract to buy and sell in Colorado has a lot of exits for a buyer. Even if you've removed a number of your standard contingencies or reduced them, there are still a lot of exits. And it can be very tempting to continue to look at other houses online and maybe even ask your agent to schedule a showing. I'm okay with it as long as it's happening within the inspection period. There is an argument that you are potentially acting in bad faith.
Right.
So back to the dating analogy, right? You've started dating and you've told this person in writing that you're really exploring a serious long-term commitment to you. And implicit in that is that you're not dating other people.
Right.
Right. And of course, we're talking about houses, not humans. But it's a very similar kind of, I think in similar terms, right? You really shouldn't be on dating apps and looking at other houses if you are committed to purchasing one and fully vetting it. But people often do. And the question, there's a gray area, right? Life is full of gray areas. And this gray area is, let's say the house you're thinking about buying has some issues with it, right? And there are legitimate inspection issues that you've discovered. And you're trying to decide, is it worth staying with this house or not? Well, knowing the condition of the other homes that are currently on the market, that's a choice for you to terminate your contract and go after a different one. And is that in bad faith? I don't think that phase it's in bad faith. The day after your inspection objection and termination deadlines expire and you're continuing to do this, yeah, and then you find a disingenuous reason. You asked your agent to terminate on home inspection. I'm sorry.
Or ask loan your terms. Agent
loan terms. I didn't like my loan terms. Or, hey, I don't like the cost to insure this property. Or, hey, there's a rule in the HOA. I don't like that. But really the reason is there's a better house on the market. That is acting in bad faith. And if discovered, although difficult to prove, it has been proven. I've heard stories. I'll tell the story. So this is a story where we don't name this person, but they are a Boulder realtor. They are quite successful, actually. They sell a lot of houses. And the story this person told me is that her client decided to terminate based on things going on in their personal life. And there could have been other houses involved, too, but there was a lot of stress going on, and they just decided they can't buy this house. It's too much. Whatever's happening. Maybe their relationship was crumbling. I think it was a sick family member was a contributing factor to adding to the stress.
That's tough,
and they just
yeah.
felt overwhelmed. And they're like, get me out of this deal. And so their buyer's agent, and this is our colleague, terminated and checked the box loan approval. Now, this is a time period when loan approval and loan terms were not two separate deadlines. They were one deadline for loan. And so it was the buyer's sole subjective discretion that the loan's not acceptable.
Okay. Right? So, yeah, even though at the time it was loan availability, it encompassed the whole thing.
The specific deadline was a little different than in today's contract.
Okay.
Right? The way it's worded is different. We're talking – and they did this. Actually, the reason they split the contract dates is to prevent this sort of behavior. Agents and their buyers and their agents misusing – the deadlines to terminate on disingenuous reasons. So this listing agent was pretty clever and smelled something was fishy and immediately called the lender and said, hey, how's it going with our deal? And the lender said, it's perfect. We're fully approved. We're ready to close. Because this was right before closing. And so this buyer was clearly trying to get out on loan approval when the loan was already approved and there's nothing wrong with the loan. And so this listing agent called them back and said, you know, there's a problem. You can terminate, but we're keeping your earnest money because you're acting in bad faith. We're not going to release it. And because of what they discovered. And it turned out that the full story did come out. They threw themselves at the mercy of the seller. They ended up going into it's not arbitration,
specific.
It's mediation with the title company. Because it's not automatic. You're not awarded, I think it was like $100,000 of earnest money. It was an expensive house. You're not automatically awarded the money back, right? Like the seller has to sign a release, the buyer has to sign a release to get the money out of the title company escrow. And the title company does not want to play court of decision here. So they had to settle on this or go to court, district court, which is going to take years to go through the process to get this money released. So most people will work out a settlement. They ended up losing half. In mediation, they agreed to give the seller half the earnest money. And the seller felt bad for them, but also was pissed off at the disingenuous behavior that they attempted to lie to get out of the contract. And it was clear that if they had not lied... they probably would have gotten 100% back because most humans are not awful people. And if I was selling a house and you were the buyer, Hamish, and you said, yeah, my grandmother's dying, I know we're supposed to close in 3 days. Can you let me out of this contract? I would probably just let you out completely. If I really was being hard, I would say, okay, well, I'm going to have 30 to 45 days of carrying cost. So I want you to pay, if I don't sell it, we're going to keep your money in escrow and I'm going to ding you for my carrying cost. And that's only if I'm being kind of not a nice person.
Got you on a bad day. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's really the business decision is, okay, if I have to carry it for another month or two, you pay that out of your earnest money. Otherwise we're going to district court and it could sit there for 2.5 years. I don't care.
Yeah.
Right. I let my attorney charge you attorney's fees too. That's fine by me. But I'm a nice person, and if you told me your grandmother was dying, I would let you out of the contract. Because while we're in dispute trying to determine what's going on with your earnest money, most brokerages are going to say, well, you can't sell this house to somebody else while you're holding on to somebody else's earnest money. Like, because the earnest money is for purchase. Like, you're entering a dangerous place, and at that point, as a real estate broker who wants to keep his license, I'm going to say I'm not an attorney and this is not legal advice. And you should contact an attorney who can actually advise you about what to do in the circumstance, because it is so unusual. But before you contact the attorney, I would encourage you to, well, maybe you contact an attorney and then go try to work this out with the sell side before you actually file lawsuits and drag people into court, because it's a disaster for everyone. So, and that reminds me, this podcast is not legal advice. And it's not even real estate advice. Honestly, it's entertainment. And that's mostly because we don't have a relationship with the audience. We don't know who's viewing this. If you're our client, contact us and we will 100% give you legit real estate advice that doesn't require a disclaimer. Because it's such a crazy litigious world out there. All right, why don't we kind of got a little sideways about future-proofing. Talked a little bit about schools. We did not talk about long-term appreciation trends. So this is something that you can think about mitigating your opportunity cost with. And the way we've done that in the past, and it's rare. I have one client, I'm going to name him if he's listening, David, I'm just going to give you the first name, was the first client that asked me to take the standard property search, right? So I think we were looking for a 3-plus bedroom house, 2-plus bathrooms, 3,000 square feet, 2-car garage, built newer than 1990, dump all of that from a neighborhood in Boulder called Lake Valley into a spreadsheet, and then do the same thing for homes that are in Indian Peaks. And we did exactly the same search, all of the data into a spreadsheet. And then we did regressions on both of those data sets, which is the sum of least squares. It's a trend line. It just plots a trend line on the data. And then we looked at the slope or the steepness of that trend line, which is equivalent to appreciation, to see what's appreciating faster. And there was no surprise. Boulder, in general, appreciates much faster than outside of Boulder. And other areas, you know, historically have not done as well. That's also why they're cheaper, right? You can afford more house in Lafayette than you can in the city of Boulder. Lake Valley is technically Longmont, but it acts and follows Boulder much closer than Longmont because it's the first neighborhood on the north side of town. And you can thereby at least have an analysis, a data point, as you navigate this challenging decision on where should you buy the house, Lake Valley or Indian Peaks. And both are great neighborhoods. But you wouldn't know on the surface that Lake Valley historically has appreciated better than Indian Peaks or vice versa. It could be Indian Peaks. I don't remember the data. In fact, I think our analysis was actually City of Boulder versus Lake Valley. And he ended up buying in Lake Valley, but at least he had the data point, right? Because appreciation is not the most important thing for most primary home buyers. Long-term satisfaction is the most important thing.
Right. Yeah, it's... I'll go for it.
No, go ahead.
Well, I've lost my train of thought.
Well, the only thing I was going to say is that and this is the easy take-home kind of rule of thumb, and that is the best investment decisions don't make the best living circumstances, right? We're talking about a home for you and your family if it's your primary residence. That, in my opinion, should take first priority over investment performance. If it's an investment property, totally different game. You don't care about the emotional factors. Well, for yourself personally, you should care about the emotional factors in terms of how the real estate is perceived by the market. That's a big deal.
So, yeah, I guess that's where I was going is you pulled all the functional requirements out onto the spreadsheet, so you're dealing with relatively the same, you know, product. It was more or less location and then running the trend there. So I guess as long as it's like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? As long as you're filling that pyramid, then you can start to focus on those other factors.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, I think that that's a good analogy, although Maslow's pyramid, I'm not sure, is still a practice model, but it certainly was when I was in college. I think that we've gotten a little bit deeper than Maslow right now, but still, it's true. If you don't have your functional needs met, that's all you care about in life, right? If you don't have food, clothing, and shelter, nothing else matters. And then once you have food, clothing, and shelter, and you're earning a base level of income, the additional, and I think this is the most interesting thing about Maslow, the additional per increment unit of dollars don't track with happiness at all. Yeah. So basically, be careful with the job you pick, because if it's all about the money, you probably aren't going to be happy in the long run, because once you make a certain amount, it's like you better
diminishing returns.
Work.
Yeah.
If you want a happy life, it's just, that's the only thing. If you're okay with not being happy, then
go for it.
Choose it at will. So with real estate, the equivalent is price point, bedrooms and baths. This is what I call functional needs, right? Location has to make sense. The schools that you're choosing have to make sense. And then there's these additional factors like, well, future proofing. Am I going to need a home stair lift in 20 years? Or is my mother or father, or the grandparents that are getting older, that are going to need at-home care? Are they going to move in with me? And do I have space for them in this home? How is that going to work? All of these things are important. Maybe my adult children are struggling with their lives. They are not sure where they're going. And having an additional bedroom and bath that they can stay in for an extended period of time, the home is large enough that it doesn't feel like we're living on top of each other, that could be important to you. It all depends. And our job in helping understand opportunity cost is to talk about things that maybe they haven't thought of and ask those questions. And frequently when it comes to couples, which are often buying a home together, they're so busy that they don't have time to have these conversations. And so we do these conversations during showings. Or sometimes if they really like the house, we have the conversation in the car, because we don't want to have listening devices listen to our entire conversation and know exactly how much these buyers love the house, especially if we're trying to negotiate a deal. Ring and Nest have changed how we work with our clients. I just assume we're being recorded, and try to, even if there's no visible camera, just assume you're being recorded. Try not to get too excited. Point out a few positives, point out a few negatives, and then if you want to have a conversation about negotiation and offers, let's do that in the car, or at minimum, let's go for a walk so we're not right in front of the house.
Yeah. Poker face.
That's right, poker face. Isn't that a song? Like a Lady Gaga song?
It's a big one.
And that's a very important thing to keep in some segment of my brain is that song. all right. Agent selection. Okay, so we've talked about long-term appreciation and opportunity costs. We have not talked about agent selection. So in choosing a romantic partner, you have, in theory, you've made a commitment. In choosing a real estate agent, you're also making a commitment to work with this person, and the vast majority of agents will ask you to sign an exclusive. I don't usually do that the first meeting. It's usually after the third or fourth showing. And I warn my clients, this is coming. Like, I'm going to ask you to, like, we need to go exclusive. There's only so much Osmond and Hamish to go around. And so we can't just work with you and in the hopes we find the right house. We need to establish a working relationship that protects the value of our time and makes the exclusivity clear that we represent you as a buyer, not the seller. All of those things are very important, and there are standard agreements for it. But while you're shopping houses, you should also, in the beginning phases, be shopping agents.
And that actually, that's an opportunity cost for us, too. If we're out here, you know, without a exclusive at that point, we're kind of getting into it unprotected as well. So opportunity cost goes on all sides.
There is, right? If we're working with you without an exclusive arrangement, we may not be working with a better buyer. I mean, that's a great point. We recently declined to work with a seller. It happens maybe once or twice a year. And literally the next day I have one of our three-time past clients reach out to us, two-time past clients at that point, now three-times past clients. They just closed, and they're ready to go. And the working relationship is so positive and mutually supportive. It makes us work harder. It was like like the universe, if you want to do the woo-woo, Boulder woo-woo.
It is Boulder, yeah. The universe
was testing me and us, and we clearly made the right decision because it immediately sent us an amazing client relationship and a smooth transaction the whole way through. Mm-hmm. And one that was also feasible and respectful. So yeah, we also are shopping our clients when shopping, sorry, not the right word, evaluating our buyers and sellers when we meet them to ask, is this a relationship that is respectful? Can we help them be successful? Are they asking for things that are just impossible? Like, if the data doesn't support this being a possibility, right? You want an amazing house in the city of Boulder and you want to pay $500,000 for it. I'm just going to say, I'm sorry. That sounds great, but I'm not going to send out 100 letters to orphans and widows and people that are elderly trying to scam them into selling you, their $1 million house for $500,000. It's unethical and it's extremely low probability. So both of those things are a hard red flag no, being asked to do unethical things and being asked to do things that are Hail Marys. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't make any sense. So the opportunity, so here's where you get locked in, right? So let's say your friend, the agent, it's your partner's drinking buddy, your partner's golfing buddy, your partner's crocheting friend, the person that lives next door, your cousin, whatever it happens to be. If you choose somebody based on that family relationship, you may have trust, but you don't have any guarantee of competency. And this is one of the most interesting things about real estate, that people often choose their brokerage because it gives them the branding of competency, because this agency has so many deals, right? Mm-hmm. And what people don't know is most of those deals are done by a very small percentage of agents. The top 10% do the vast majority of real estate transactions. And then you have a bunch of people that do a couple of deals a year. And as an employing broker, they're a nightmare because they don't know what they're doing. They can get you into trouble. But they've chosen your brokerage because you have a brand that is recognizable. And unfortunately, as a buyer or a seller, once you choose this person, they're likely going to ask you to go into an exclusive relationship. And then you can't break up. And even if you didn't have that exclusive relationship, even if they didn't ask for a buyer agency or a listing agreement, which you have to sell a house, but let's say they didn't, now you have a friendship problem, right? Like if they're not performing, it's really hard to fire this person because they're a family member or a friend. So it's critically important when you're shopping for a home or you're thinking about selling a home to be really judicious in your agent selection.
It's interesting. Real estate is largely referral clients. And so I think it's really common for people to go based off of that trust of, relationships, either family or their partner or, second or third degree. And it's just such a strange kind of thing. You really want to choose somebody with experience and competency and a proven track record versus just kind of like a word of mouth type of deal,
Yeah. Well, it's not uncommon in other industries too.
Yeah.
So if you look at financial performance of investment companies, mutual funds, you will find that they cherry pick the dates for the fund performance in the prospectus, which is their marketing vehicle. All the marketing materials, there's a wall of disclaimers, right? And the reason that wall of disclaimers exists is because they're cherry picking data to show performance, but in reality, they may not be performing very well at all. And so one of the ways to see through the fog and mirrors of marketing or the lack of available information to accurately evaluate the performance of your chosen agent. How do you see through this? You ask the people that are affiliated. So if you really want to know who's an incredible agent and who's not, talk to a closer. Mm. Call up the title company or look up their org chart. And you don't necessarily want to talk to management. You want to talk to the people that actually run the deal. And maybe you want to talk to two or three and ask them, this is kind of an unusual question. You don't know me. My name is Osman, and I'm looking to buy a house or sell a house. And, this is weird, but do you have a couple of recommendations of people that you think are just really competent at this type of property that you really are impressed with their professionalism, because they deal with these people all the time. They deal with the tantrums. They see the sideways negotiations. They see the deals break up. And because the agent is not behooven to be polite or respectful to this person necessarily, they also are going to see bad behavior like disrespect.
Yeah.
Right. It's sort of like the first date and the person is disrespectful to the waiter.
Yeah, that's a good red flag.
You know right away this is not somebody you want to like probably be in a long-term relationship with. And so the title company is a great proxy. If you really want to go guerrilla on interviewing agents and finding agents, call the best title companies and ask who is killing it.
That's clever,
in terms of professionalism, in terms of competency. Not in terms of how good they are at marketing themselves. And make sure this person doesn't have some sort of personal relationship. That's the other question. Like, are you arm's length from this person that you're recommending? I mean, it's only a 15-minute phone call, but it requires skill to get that sort of information from a stranger. And the other person to ask is about investment professionals are CPAs and accountants. They actually see the numbers, right? Yeah. And they are arm's length from the investment advisor. So their client is the one that bank accounts going up and down. Their accounts are moving up and down. But the CPA or accountant is not behooven to the investment advisor. Mm-hmm. And so if they see a pattern in their clients, everyone's using Hamish Crabb as their investment manager here in Boulder. I want Hamish Crabb because he's killing it. He knows what he's doing. And the accountant knows. And the market, and it's such a fast end run or cut through the smoke screen of marketing to find out who's good and who's not good.
Yeah, that's a really clever technique there.
Yeah. The other thing I often look at is also how available are they? Because this business is nights and weekends. Like mm-hmm. We do a lot of nights, weekends, crazy hours, and integrating our lifestyle into the flow of real estate is really important. If I had small children, it would be so much harder.
Yeah,
I would have to have a partner that would stay at home or had a much more flexible job just because of how crazy it can be.
Or a strong team. And
I'm not saying there are great agents out there that have children. Okay, I'm not saying you can't do it, but it definitely is a factor to think about is how available are they? How widely known are they? Are they so busy that you're going to be delegated to the second or third tier of their team because they just do too many deals? That's another thing to think about, that mm-hmm. they're amazing at marketing themselves. They sell a ton of houses, but they actually aren't very available at all because of how much volume they have. And there's only so much one agent and one assistant can do. There's only so many deals we can manage at once before you have to delegate.
Yeah.
What else about agent selection? Or we covered it.
Well, there's the sell side, but I think we'll hit there as we go through.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, we're talking about agent selection. I think we can talk about the sell side of agent selection too. And that's what I meant by, you know, with how many deals they may be listing. It might be that you're not getting the attention you deserve. And what are they actually doing that's different from other agents? On the sell side, you know, as I've now been doing this almost 20 years, there's so much more than professional photography and accurate pricing that goes into high performance, particularly once the deal is live. Like our new Breck listing, I've now gotten 5 different agents who have emailed me asking for the rental history. And we have that prepared in a spreadsheet format. I am responding to those emails typically within 15 minutes and sometimes within 5. Because it's such a fast response. If it pops in my inbox, I'm like, thanks for contacting us. Here's the data. And we're prepared to do that. And once the listing is live, we're also going to follow up with every single showing with a phone call, not automated systems. And other agents are doing that too. I'm not the only one in the world that does this, but that's authentic feedback. And so if you're interviewing and you're trying to slice through the fog and mirrors of marketing for listing agents, you do want to ask, how do they manage feedback? You do want to ask, what's their negotiation style? You may want to ask specific circumstances, like what if we get a lowball? What if we get multiple offers? How are we going to handle that? What's our communication plan? How are we going to make decisions?
What are your systems?
But there's so many variables with multiple offers and any offer that it's difficult to give you a clear answer, because the circumstances are going to drive the appropriate response, and then our client is going to make a decision, not us. And you know, sometimes I regret not pushing harder when the client is making clearly not the right decision. But it's a gray area, and I've got a lot of respect for our clients. Some of them are most of them are incredibly educated and incredibly successful. We tend to represent a lot of people that are self-successful, that are not massive wealth inheritors. We tend to get not a lot of trust funders, is what I would say. We get a lot of people that have earned it. And they're really smart people, and I've got a lot of respect for those people. So when they say, well, this is what I really want to write into the additional provisions on a counter, and it makes sense. I sometimes, need to push harder when there's a downside that we haven't really thought about. And what I'm specifically talking about is getting too granular in the additional provision section of the contract to buy and sell or the counter, because if you get too granular at that phase, in the middle of multiple offers coming in, the conclusion the listing agent is going to reach very quickly and say to their client is, Osman and his buyer are a little difficult.
Mm-hmm.
We want to go with somebody who's not going to be such a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
And we're trying to be clear and specific, and they're taking it to mean, well, he's going to be difficult.
Yeah, a little too detail-oriented or however.
Yeah. All right. So, let's see. Time spent shopping is another opportunity cost to consider, right? And it plays into, we talked about this a little bit. It plays into the understanding of the available options through time. And mm-hmm. looking at last year's sales, the last 6 months of sales that match your criteria, help you understand what happens and what is the value of your time. What's your shopping window? And for the sell side, it's the low offer, right? Like, let's say you've been on the market 30 days and the trend is heading downhill, which is actually true in some neighborhoods right now in Boulder, although I think it's kind of popping back up. We're starting to see bidding wars for things that probably shouldn't get bidding wars again. Yeah. But we're also seeing a lot of agents that are underpricing intentionally, which is creating some confusion in the market. We're in a bidding war this week on a house in Lafayette, and all the data I could see looks like this house is underpriced compared to 2022. But it's been on the market. It made it through the weekend. Let's offer low. And that turned out to not be such a great move. If we had offered list, we might've actually gotten it. But there ended up being a skirmish for this house, unexpectedly. But if you're on the receiving end of an offer that's been on, and you've been on the market for a month or two, you really have to think carefully about whether you just ignore this offer. Like, you may want to counter it, even if it's an uncomfortably low offer, with what your true bottom line is, with maybe some cushion for inspection items, and not take it for granted. I've been on the writing side, on the buy side of those buyers that smell blood in the water. They think that the house has been on the market a month, so the seller must be desperate, and they really want to write the low offer that is going to get a non-response. And you write the low offer and you get a non-response, right? But then, or you finally get the seller to counter and they jump on the counter. Like, the delta between the offer and the counter is so extreme, but
you got a response.
The truth was, the buyer was faking, right? The buyer was bluffing that they were going to walk away. They really wanted the house, but they felt like they needed to honor their instincts to lowball. So knowing how to deal with lowballers is a really important conversation to have with your seller, if you're a listing agent, before you get one. You're going to say something. You had a facial expression.
Oh, no, I was just thinking about lowballing. I have a hard time, at least on like Marketplace and the kind of the personal market, lowballing people. And when it comes to houses, though, I'm pretty foreseeing how little you can get, you know.
It's, I mean, just, you're kind of, yeah, go ahead.
You can't predict which house is going to have the most demand on it, though, you know? So say it's on the market for a month and you submit an offer. Well, guess what? They got two or three other ones.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it all depends on the market. And this is why understanding the market for that particular price point, that particular neighborhood, that style of house, that level of deferred maintenance or no deferred maintenance, maybe it's turnkey and it's a spec house. Understanding the market for that is crucial to knowing what offer is going to be accepted. And you may end up leaving some money on the table because you went a little high, but you got the house and you beat out these other offers. And unfortunately, these offers are not, it's not a transparent bidding process. It is, we're 100% yeah. in the control of the listing agent, which might be me. I might be the listing agent, in which case my job is to maximize the sale price mm-hmm. and minimize the deal contingencies and increase the probability of taking this to closing.
Yeah.
And I will 100% use multiple offers to do that. And the poor buyer's agents that are out of touch. I mean, last year when we were getting like 12 offers on a listing, there were always one or two that were like completely clueless. Like, why did you even submit an offer when you're 100,000 below the herd, right? Like, you yeah. can distribute this on a chart, and there's like one or two offers that are just like are so ridiculously low. You're like, no point, next. And you end up focusing on the two or three top offers, and you get those to negotiate against each other to drive it even higher or even better. It doesn't necessarily mean more in price. It just might mean a tighter contract.
Yeah. And that's the thing.
Poor buyer's agents, maybe they're just educating their clients. You know, this is how a contract works, and that might be a good use of their time.
Yeah. Well, so we were talking about this too. I mean, this has come up a few times with clients over the year. You know, you get three or four offers in, and it's like, well, maybe we'll go to this person and ask if they can do this. Well, at the same time, we'll send a counter over here. And you're creating this, you're negotiating, but then you're very quick to go under a contract and you could be wasting their time. And it's kind of like cheating almost, but it leaves a bad taste in somebody's mouth as well. So you kind of got to negotiate or select an offer out of those three rather than try to play all three at the same time.
I mean, it's easier to play one off the other.
Yeah.
This is one of the reasons you ask your listing agent, your prospective listing agent, when you interview them about their negotiation style, because how they conduct themselves in multiple offer scenarios is crucial to your maximization of price. It's also crucial to their long-term success in the industry too, because mm-hmm. I've seen it mismanaged so many times. And those people sometimes are gone. We had an agent not so long ago. This is on one of Ian's deals and I was advising Ian on this deal. This is why I got to know about it, who the negotiation was so tough. And then there was a secondary round of negotiation over inspection issues. And for some reason, there was a very short timeline. I got to be careful with how much I say.
Enough.
There was a very short timeline between inspection resolution and closing. And so I think it might have been an estate sale. So the heirs, the ones that are selling the home, the beneficiaries of the sale, you know, they've gone through the whole grieving process, the probate process. They've listed it. It's been on the market a long time. It has not had a buyer. And now we're literally a week from closing. We're almost done. And that's when, well, they got hammered
yeah.
by the buyer.
I know this deal now.
The buyer, yeah. yeah. And the agent was like, this is my last real estate deal. They were retiring supposedly after this deal, and it was just not comfortable. Our job is on the buy side to represent the buyer's best interest. And if there's an opportunity to be aggressive, I tend to be more aggressive than most within ethical and moral bounds.
Yeah.
At some point, like if you're trying to lowball somebody that's grieving and dealing with like a spouse that just died or a cancer diagnosis, I'm just not there. I can't do it. Like if that's what you're looking for, you need a criminal real estate agent. You don't need me. I can't do it. If it's not unethical, right? They're sitting on a mountain of equity and we don't know their motivating factors. I don't know anything about the cancer diagnosis or the dead puppy or whatever it is that would make me feel bad. I'm much more happy to be hyper aggressive, but not extenuating human circumstances. I love negotiation, but I'm not a psychopath.
It's good to hear. You know, this is the first time I've heard you say that. So,
in case there was any doubt, Hamish.
Yeah.
Okay. So we were getting a little in the weeds, and. All right, let's go back to sell-side mitigation techniques for opportunities that you might miss. And one of the most important things on the sell side is to feel confidence in the value of your home. That's how we mitigate the temptation of a low offer, because you need to know the value of what you've got. And we do that process at House Einstein. We do that process in live video meetings typically. At least I do. I think Ian does it as well. We do a screen share and we go through the comps, and then we go see the comps in person, the active competitors, not just the sold comps, but the active competitors, because there are sometimes, well, there are often factors you can miss just looking at the photos,
mm-hmm.
and just looking at the listing description, because, I mean, that listing agent's job was to not show you the hoarder's house next door or the other problems and that could exist for this property. So that's how you make sure you price right. And when you get a low offer, you know the real value. You can potentially sit tight and say, no, I know the value of this house.
Yeah.
It's not 900, it's 950, and here's why. And if you want it, it's 950. But I know human nature is to want to feel some pain, so let's call it 945. I'll take five out. You can see me feel pain. You feel better. It's a better deal. Or at least it's a planned concession. You don't necessarily have to actually feel pain. You just need to plan for it. Plan for somebody's human behavior to want to extract a pound of flesh.
Exactly, yeah. Expect somewhat of a low ball, somewhat of a discount, and kind of account that into your pricing.
And from a seller's perspective, once you go to the dance with one buyer, you can't terminate.
Mm-hmm.
So it is 100% an opportunity cost to take offer from a buyer at a very low number that's going to continue to be difficult all the way to closing versus take a simple, clean offer 2 weeks from now. And you would have no way. So you have no way of knowing. You have to understand how many homes like yours have sold in the last few months. And are there unique aspects of your house, like our listing in Fraser Meadows, that was completely unlike anything else I've ever seen in Fraser Meadows?
Yeah.
Right? That the house I'm in was an outlier. And so understanding how to, well, one in whatever, how many thousands of houses are in Fraser Meadows, nothing else is like it. There are other mid-century houses in Boulder. In fact, there's one in Chautauqua right now that's listed in the sixes. But valuing that house is a completely different analysis, and you have to be patient to wait for the right buyer that understands why this property is worth so much more than the neighbors who don't have the giant lot, don't have the unique architecture, don't have the story that's tied to the history of Boulder. All right. So property under contract analysis, this is another piece of opportunity cost mitigation. It's really just market research. The more you can do to research and understand the market, the lower the opportunity cost. And in this particular case, before you write the offer, what we often do is talk to the other similar properties. So right now we're looking in Lafayette, and we've got a buyer looking in the Indian Peaks neighborhood and also Wanaka Lake. And we just swung and missed on a house this week. But in the future, when we write an offer, and for this one too, it doesn't hurt to talk to other listing agents that are under contract,
yeah,
in that price range, in that neighborhood. They will, almost 100% of them will scratch my back too. I will call them looking for market intelligence, and I'll ask them in a really nice way, you know, how'd your listing go? I don't give them yes or no's. I give them opportunities to talk. Although sometimes it's better to go just a tricky question, like how much above list did you get? Because yeah, then they don't think about protecting the info. They're like, oh, we didn't get above list, or wow, we're way above list, or no, we ended up low. And it's like before they can even think, because the question is not, you know, did you get list price?
Yeah.
Or the question isn't what is it under contract for, because that would feel too invasive. But you say, did you get over 950?
Yeah. Did you get what, right? You were asking?
And you can kind of triangulate where you end up by how they respond, how quickly they answer, and how many offers did you get? They usually tell me.
Yeah.
And so now we know what the real market is, at least was 2 weeks ago, how many other buyers are in there that are likely to chase this listing, and that might affect how aggressive you go on your offer price.
And that's pretty much the exact advice you gave me when I'm still looking, but a house came along that was pretty much exactly what I was looking for, but my price point's extremely competitive, and yeah, it was under contract the next day. And your advice, you know, call the listing agent, tell them kind of what I'm doing, and get an idea so I can actually craft a competitive offer for the first offer I do right.
That's right. I mean, that's the first thing you do. And Hamish is licensed, although he doesn't work in his current capacity as a commission agent. He is buying his first house, and he gets to be part of all these deals that Sophie, Ian, and I do.
Yeah, great.
But that is always stage one, right? There's an order of operations for buying a house, and the first order of operations is, do you really want this house?
Because
if you're not sure, there's no point in doing these further things, because it's not that they just involve effort. They don't answer the first question. You know, if you're not interested in the house, why are we finding out? Why are we starting negotiations? Because the moment I pick up the phone and call the other side, which is what I do, if your answer is yes, I'm calling the agent and checking in. How's it look? You know, are there any things we need to know about the house? You know, it's lots of warm, fuzzy, sweet talk at first because we're trying to establish a nice working relationship with this person. I also have a foreign-sounding name. And if I just lob in an email, you know, there's instant biases that come into play. And
yeah,
that's
statistically,
life.
Okay,
I'm not trying to criticize agents for being prejudiced or biased. Everyone has them. I have biases. But when you pick up the phone and call and they hear you asking smart questions and they hear you trying to work through issues and be collaborative, now they know you're collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to say I'm collaborative in the cover letter and I work on getting solutions done. They can hear it in the tone of your voice. When you ask about what does a seller need besides price, is there a closing date that works best for them? Are there any unusual inclusions? And what do I need to do to get this deal done? And if they say, look, it looks like we're getting three offers, submit on Monday, you know, then we know. And I can have that discussion with my clients about, all right, what does Monday look like?
Mm-hmm.
What additional info do we need to know to help you craft a compelling and competitive offer that doesn't blow the budget, that's not all about price?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the one question that's impossible to answer is how much should I offer? Because sometimes the personal factors are much more important than what the market says you should offer. Because the market's opaque at best. But I'm a bad liar. You will see it on my face if I think you're going crazy. Like, that's really high.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a listing that's on the market in the Holiday neighborhood right now. That person paid, I think, $250,000 over list last summer. Like, early summer, late spring. And now it's back on market, and they're just trying to get their money back. And I doubt they're going to get it because it was priced right. And I don't know what was going on in that deal, but the buyer decided to go hundreds of thousands over list. And, I mean, they're screwed.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say. They are stuck with that house for a long time, or they're going to take a $200,000 loss to sell it.
Regrets. Opportunity cost, right?
Regrets and opportunity cost because they can't. I mean, odds are they don't have the money to go buy another house. Whatever reason that house is not working, it has some functional issues, doesn't have a real front yard, that sort of stuff. But it's still a great house. It's just maybe their life changed, right? Their
mm-hmm.
job circumstances changed, or they're having a baby, or they have a grandparent moving in, or they suddenly have a debilitating issue where they can't climb stairs. Who knows? But because they overpaid for an asset that they shouldn't have overpaid for, they're probably stuck with it. Because most people don't have the liquidity to buy. It's Boulder. People do in this town. But in normal real estate land, most people don't have the cash kicking around to go buy a second house and carry two mortgages.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's another thing, right, is when you're looking to purchase, at least 5 years, you need to be able to hold on to the house.
Well, so I have that. Have I walked you through that model, the buy versus rent model?
You have, yeah. The spreadsheet, okay. Yeah.
If you spend some time playing with that model, you will find that it's actually closer to 3 years.
Hmm.
So you can put in the scenarios where you see, like, homes have depreciated in value or rent increases or drops over time. And in the vast majority of feasible circumstances, even conservative projections is what people would say on Wall Street, 3 years is about break even for renting in that model. But I like to say five. And the reason I say five is because it decreases the risk of these people getting a loss. It helps my clients think longer term. So
mm-hmm.
5 years is what I recommend, but 3 years financially is usually what is break even compared to rent in normal times.
Normal times.
Yeah. 7% interest is not normal times.
Oh, man.
But we are watching somebody close at 5.6 next week.
Jealous.
Or 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah, 5.68.
My email from my lender said 6.7 today.
Well, maybe you should try this lender.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm shocked at how aggressive they could get, and it wouldn't hurt you to try. So it's the lender on the deal in Noble Park.
Okay.
Yeah, that person is really, really on it. And so we love our lending relationships. This is not disloyalty, but our clients make the ultimate call. And loans are effectively a commodity product, and lenders have to compete. So they need to be competitive on rate. They also need to have good communication. They also not need to introduce fictitious charges into the deal, which we've seen lenders do in the past. It's harder to do today, but we fired a lender for that one. They need to not try strong arm tactics on our clients. We had to fire two lenders for that one, where they're trying to guilt and shame our buyer for switching lenders. We're even considering switching lenders. How dare you shop my rates after you told me you're working with me yesterday? And now today you're shopping my rates? How dare you? Who are you people? It's like, why are you why are you verbally abusing their your humans client? Trying to maximize their monthly payment is what they have to live with for maybe 30 years. And if you can't compete, you can't compete, but don't guilt and shame and don't verbally abuse. That's not going to work. Yeah. Say, thank you, I can't compete. I hope to earn your business next time. And you'll stay on our list because it's not, because rates constantly change and lending programs constantly change. So just because you're not competitive today doesn't mean you won't be competitive on the next deal. So the way that people get added to our list, Hamish, is exactly how the Noble Park lender is getting added to our list, because the buyer is bringing them to the table and they are knocking it out of the park in communication, and their rates are the lowest I've seen in a long time, and they're emphasizing it. They're like, $1,000 fee, no point buy down. I mean, I'll look at the settlement statement when I finally get it. I want to see how this actually played out. Like, are there weird charges in there? But this person is selling to both sides of the deal, the agents in both sides of the deal, aggressively. And we're going to see in 2 weeks if this person actually delivered what they said they're delivering.
Yeah. It'd be cool to have another one on our recommended list.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, I think they're worth calling. And let them run your credit or whatever, and start to work on your package and see what they can do for you, because they came in at like 1% below everyone else.
Yeah, and that would be a huge advantage at this point. So,
oh my God, massive.
Yeah,
massive advantage. Yeah, and you know, don't forget about the buy downs, right? The 3-2 buy downs, the 2-1 buy downs, and the fact that a lot of sellers are crediting buyers for closing costs, which are going to buy down rates.
Yeah.
So you can offer more than list. In fact, that's what's going on in the house we lost. That offer, that agent, the person who's buying the house, is offering $10,000 over list, and then the seller is contributing $10,000 to the buyer's closing costs and prepaids. So basically, that's 100% going to buy down the rate.
Yeah. A little funny, but kind of, I don't know. It's all negotiable, right? So it works out. So you can make it happen.
In the scale of real estate shenanigans, that's on the very low end. All right, we have been talking now for how long?
Hour 12.
So let's see, have we covered everything? We talked about the definition. We used some real-life examples of opportunity cost trade-offs, right? Dating, marriages, and financial investments, cars versus stocks. And we both love cars, and they're horrible decisions. Real estate typically floats, so it's usually not a horrible decision, but certainly doesn't perform like Amazon stock over the last 20 years. And, you know, the opportunity of time, the time factor is really important. Agent selection, both on buy and sell side of the deal. And then some of the common questions, you know, the better house in the future, will prices go up or down in the future? Which is why it's so important to start looking at the trend and what's happening in the market for your particular house, or the house you're searching for, or the house you're thinking about buying. And of course, I keep emphasizing this, the most important factor is is the agent selection. Is how you go about it, the questions you ask. You should not lean toward hiring your friend. In fact, I would advise you to be careful with friends or family. I have friends or family, so I don't want them not to choose me because I'm saying this. But I also, you know, I think we're very competent in what we do, so hopefully they do choose us. But I also am never offended if my personal friends have decided they would rather work with somebody else. That's okay, too. There are other great agents in the market. All right, I think that covered this podcast, Hamish.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I enjoyed this one.
If you're looking for Hamish and I and want to engage us in real estate, we are at houseeinstein.com. We work incredibly closely on each of our deals, and we tend to focus in the Denver and Boulder market, and now we're moving into the mountains and Summit, so we do work there as well. We just had our first listing. It just went live this week. Check it out at houseeinstein.com. You can check out our YouTube, our socials. We're on every platform, although TikTok is not our favorite. We even have a little bit of stuff on TikTok. I think we're going to probably stop using TikTok because I feel like we might be going to war with China pretty soon. So TikTok is probably not where we want to build a platform. But in any event, that's us. Really appreciate you joining us. Any final thoughts, Hamish?
I think you nailed them.
Okay. All right. We'll catch you next time. Thanks for joining us at for the House Einstein podcast number 5.
All righty. Thanks, everyone.